The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we've entered a new year, and of course, with the inauguration, we've entered another 4 years. The stock market's over 13,000. I mean, could things get any better?
Well, with the recent release of our DVD, An American Reckoning, we would take sort of the opposite view. Even though the Dow is at 13,000, and with four more years of the incumbent, what we see is truly an American reckoning. When we described the fuse being lit, we were talking about the dollar, we were talking about the debt markets, and the concern we have in those particular markets. The idea is that sometime in the next 2 to 4 years, we have major, major concerns and major issues which we'll address, more than just speed bumps in the U.S.
So even though the Dow is above 13,000, which, you know, for reminder's sake, we were there about 10 or 12 years ago, but we are there now again, and it seems to be rising. What you're saying is that's not something to party about at this point.
You know, in communication with Alan Newman here recently, he said that the undeniable fact is that the entirety of the U.S. stock market is worth less now than at the end of 1999. And I think the point that he's making there is that indexes don't necessarily tell the whole story. You've got the S&P, you've got the Dow, you've got the NASDAQ. You've also got a number of companies which have either gone by the wayside altogether or right. have traded themselves to levels where they've been removed from the indexes completely. And what you see in these indexes appears to be good news. And truly, it is. Let's not minimize that. But again, the undeniable fact is that the entirety of U.S. stocks are worth less today than they were in 1999. That's powerful. Now, at the same time, Alan has suggested that margin levels are comparable today in the stock market, comparable to the stock market capitalization. Those levels are the highest we've seen since 1929.
Oh, my.
I don't need to tell you what happened in 1929, but I think there is that issue of animal spirits, or is that issue of speculation running rampant on the street today.
Well, you know, if you only have enough money to buy one, why don't you take that money and buy 3, 4, 5, 10 and just take your risk? And that's what you're saying about margin levels. Something else, though, it's not just margin that's in the market. The stock market has become more like a hot potato game than an actual buy and hold game. That's changing.
In our conversation many months ago with Alan Newman, this was a part of the topics covered. The high-frequency trading and what we've seen as the norm today on Wall Street, essentially reduction of the holding period where someone used to buy a stock, let's say circa 1991, and they held it for an average, which means some investors held it far longer than this, but an average of 21.2 months.
So almost 2 years was the average holding time.
And then by the end of that decade, 1999, we have folks who are only holding stocks 10.4 months. So you see this declining trend, and then a year after that, so just the year 2000, it's 5.9 months. By 2008, it's 2.6 months. Today, holding periods are almost nothing as computers buy and sell and try to pick up a penny here and pick up a penny there. Really, what has occurred over the last decade, most intensely, we're talking about two decades in scope here, really it's intensified over the last 10 years. The exchanges have done a huge disservice to the investing public by catering to high-frequency traders, and that is at the expense of a core of retail investors. So it really is no surprise when we talk about the Dow at 13.5, 13.6, the levitation in the stock market is at least partially explained by this automatic bidding process. Again, we're not talking about people who are buying stocks. We're not talking about an investing class that's buying stocks. We're talking about a group of technical traders who are using algorithms and computer models. And basically, you could take your double martini at 9 a.m. because, frankly, you don't have to show up for work. Why? Because the computer's doing all the work for you. Your brain can be absent once you've written the code.
It's like it's running a scan, except for it's running a buy.
And again, from 2010 lows, the Dow is up 35%. That's in the face of $402 billion in net sales from domestic equity funds. Step it back a little bit, as we have before, and I appreciate Newman putting these numbers together. $585 billion. If you go back to 2007, $585 billion of net sales of domestic equity funds. There's been, in the last week, the recent $8 billion surge in equity mutual funds. That is money coming into the market. This is the first major surge of investor activity into mutual funds. And then, of course, you strip away revisions of that number, which took out $5 billion, and you strip away the ETF liquidations in the same time frame. And actually, you only have about $268 million going into equities. So we have not seen a reversal of the trend. That's my point, is you continue to see the general public exit the market.
Well, I'll tell you, though, Dave, something that I know you watch and has caused huge problems in the past. Mutual funds, when their cash levels get too low, let's say something does happen where people become a little nervous. Well, anytime somebody's a little nervous and they want to sell that mutual fund, if it has no cash, is going to have to go out and sell shares. And that can compound on itself. We saw that in 1987. We've seen that in 2008, 2007. These cash levels, well, you have to keep a little bit in the bank so that you can pay out the people without having to sell shares.
If you go back to an earlier decade, you could usually find 5, 10, even 12% sitting in cash, and that was prudent management. Now, in the last 10, 15 years, you know, sort of fast forward a bit, you've seen a more common trend of 5% or less, where if you are almost fully invested, you're sort of in that 1 to 2% range in terms of cash levels. And we are today, in terms of mutual fund cash levels, resting at 2007 numbers.
Well, let's back up for a second. 2007 was right before our last crash.
Yeah, I mean, who needs reminding? Again, we talked about 1929 earlier. Maybe no one needs a reminder of what the 2007 and 2008 period looked like, but those were the highs for the decade. Risk management and caution was set aside. Cash levels at mutual funds are an indication of money managers' concerns, and they are lower today than they were in 2000, and as we said, on par with that 2007-8 period.
Well, David, obviously the guys who are managing these mutual funds know a whole lot more than the CEOs of the corporations that they're buying, because the CEOs seem to be selling more shares than buying right now.
Well, and we've talked about the insider selling issue before, but I think that issue of industry competition amongst hedge funds, amongst mutual funds, amongst asset managers, when a trend is in place, everyone wants to jump on board because no one likes to be sort of outperformed or outgunned because they run the risk of seeing assets move. Now, this is really what you have in the case of impatient investors. So that's what fund managers understand, and that's why they will all move in one herd at one time. You have to be all in. It's almost like the professional version of keeping up with the Joneses.
Well, the Joneses don't necessarily run the corporation, though, Dave. The Joneses are the guys who are buying in the mutual funds, but the guys who are running the corporations, what we call the insiders, have to show when they're buying and selling. They're selling a whole lot more than they're buying right now.
Well, and that disproportionate insider selling, particularly in the retail space, has been something we've discussed, or maybe it was that I discussed that on Bloomberg last year. But perhaps investors don't appreciate what a forward PE is, a price earnings multiple, because you look at a company like Amazon, and its forward PE is estimated to be at 157. That is, you are paying in today's price for 157 years worth of future earnings.
Well, let's just stop for a second and re-explain. Sometimes we just have to look at the simplicity of the concept. Let's say you went out and bought a company for $1 million, and you knew that company was going to earn you $100,000 a year. Well, that would have a PE of 10 to 1. In other words, it would take 10 years at $100,000 a year to pay for that $1 million investment in the company.
What we're saying is 157 years is how long it would take. And again, this is of future earnings to pay for the current share price of Amazon.
You better be taking your vitamins, Dave.
Well, and if that doesn't raise the hair on the back of your neck, the price compared to reported earnings is a wee bit higher. Now, reported earnings is different than future earnings because, frankly, we don't know what any company is going to earn in the future, but there is sort of the forward projection. And when you back away and say, well, what is their current PE versus their forward PE, it is a little bit higher. What are we making versus what we believe someday we will make? You are paying for 3,252 years worth of earnings. This is one of the most popular stocks on the planet today, and you are paying for 3,252 years worth of earnings.
So what you're saying, Dave, I was talking about a company that was making $100,000 a year at 10 to 1 if you bought it for $1 million. What you're saying, they weren't making $100,000 a year. They were making a few dollars a year, and it takes about, what'd you say, 3,200 years to actually pay the company off.
I mean, just as a thought experiment, if you're counting back the years, and of course you're paying for future performance, but this is just as a reference, 3,252 years ago, Moses had been dead for about 34 years. Joshua had recently passed away. I mean, in other words, investors are packing a lot of future hope into a company with razor-thin margins. Now, I have to be honest, I love ordering things on Amazon. Why? Mm-hmm. Because I can have my books in 2 days right. or less the next day. It's absolutely fantastic, and I love to order books. So, right. you know, there is this healthy relationship. I love Amazon. I buy from Amazon. I understand why people love Amazon, too. But what I don't understand is 3,252 years' worth of earnings is packed into the current PE. Who are you?
What I want to know then is what's packed into the rest of the stock market, because Amazon actually is a relatively healthy company compared to a lot of the companies out there right now in the stock market. Where are we going as a whole? What's the index looking like?
Well, and this is, I think, where Alan Newman's most recent comments, suggestion of a 20% reversal to the downside, and the time frame that he gives for that is imminent. The issue here is that we don't have a firm foundation for growth globally. We don't. And I know that there's many pundits who like to argue, oh, well, listen, we saw great numbers from China in the first quarter. We've addressed that to some degree. There's reasons and explanations for why we have positive numbers. We'll talk about Brazil in a few minutes here because we see the same thing. Again, you massage a few numbers here, massage a few numbers there, and you end up with positive performance. But the real issue here is we have root rot. We don't have an expansion of credit. We have a reversal of globalization to some degree. And we don't have growth in the global economy. So there is sort of an overestimation in the Dow. And yes, there could be a significant correction. Is Newman right? I don't know. We'll see. But a 20% reversal.
That's 2,700 points.
Dude. Oh, sure. Yeah, that takes us down close to 11.5, 10.5, potentially on the Dow, and maybe 10,050 on the S&P. These are numbers which are a little bit more compelling from a value standpoint. But ultimately, we think if you're going back to, again, a former guest of ours that's been on the cyclically adjusted PE or the Q ratio, you actually have 40 to 60% downside when all is said and done. Now, is that this year? I doubt it. But it could very seriously occur during this next 4 years. When we talk about an American reckoning, this is not just a political and social issue. This is very much a financial and economic issue. And they are all combined in one bad stew.
Well, and you know, the United States is not in a vacuum. We're not an island anymore. It is the world. And right now, you know, the guys that you are acquainted with across the pond right now who pay real close attention to Europe and the Latin American countries and Asia, what are they saying from that side of the pond?
Through the years, we've gotten to know the folks that publish the Global European Anticipation Bulletin, and they see major headwinds for the U.S., for the U.K., for Japan, for Brazil. Their list doesn't end here, but there are several countries which are at a crossroads politically and fiscally, and they look at that kind of combination and say, okay, essentially we've divided the major power players into two groups. So in that first category, you're talking about the U.S., the U.K., Japan, Israel. Those are the sort of top picks.
Those are the ones that haven't really changed much since the crisis.
Right, operating on the same basis. And there are those countries that have changed institutional structures and processes following the crisis, and in their view are better prepared for sort of a new and different social and geopolitical construct in future years. And that's something that we'll discuss on another occasion. That's not our topic today. But 2 years ago, their founder joined us on the commentary from Paris, and we discussed Europe. We discussed other issues. Unfortunately, Franck Biancheri passed away this last October. He had been ill for a number of years, but they continue to publish fantastic stuff through LEAP 2020 and the GEAB. Again, it's the Global European Anticipation Bulletin. And what was unique to me was in that list of, again, the U.S., the U.K., Japan, and Brazil. Brazil is not a usual country on the list of least prepared or most at jeopardy in the world after the crisis, and it stands out. And in their view, Brazil is just at a tipping point.
Well, what's amazing, too, is Brazil's been looked at almost as a model here recently. You know, as far as growth, it represented this new emerging market out there. And what they're saying at this point is it may be the one that's most in danger.
This week in The Economist, this was underscored looking at the numbers from Brazil. 2012 economic growth was penciled out at about 1% GDP growth, except, and this is the problem, except that the headline number underestimates inflation. And of course, we do the same thing here.
Sure.
We use an exceptionally friendly deflator. I think everyone knows what a deflator is by now, the factor in the GDP calculations that account for inflation. Last year, the government, in addition to using faulty inflation numbers, this is the Brazilian government, not ours in this case, last year the government also capped gasoline prices. and they froze municipal transport costs in order to contain inflation even further. But there's even more to that. To get a positive GDP figure, they also brought forward dividends from state-owned enterprises. And again, that's sort of bringing future income into 2012 revenues. And last but not least, they also raided the sovereign wealth fund that they set up in 2008. So when you look at 1% GDP growth, is it really 1% GDP growth? This is the issue. The B in brick is slipping, and the challenge for them in the future is going to be managing inflation.
Well, and that's the thing that we've brought out so many times, Dave. You can have as much growth as you want, but if inflation is outpacing the growth, you're still going backwards.
This is also a conundrum for them because there's a presidential election in 2014, and while they may want to stimulate the economy using monetary policy, the problem is they already have inflation at a 6.5%, and that's at the upper end of their acceptable range. So that is going to be the challenge in that part of the world, and specifically Brazil, is managing inflation. Presidential election, again, stimulus leading up to that time frame is set against a rising inflationary trend. Brazilian Central Bank has a number of challenges. Now, lastly, you've got the employment figures from Brazil, which have been very strong. They come out at about 4.9%. But it was an interesting note from an investment banker at a Brazilian bank, Itaú, Ilian Goldfun. He was noting that the employment figures don't reflect the overhang of workers. Essentially, you still have tons of employment because people have been kept on. The extremely high cost of firing them,
it sounds a little like France to me.
Exactly. So, I mean, you see a better number in France than you do in Spain, but your ability to fire someone is very, very difficult in a space like that. And that's what he was noting, is essentially that as you come into 2013 and 2014, we may very well see the employment numbers slip from 4.9 and start to rise from there to 5, 6, 7, 8%. You know, the Brazilian government won't want to see mass layoffs, of course, in 2013 or early 2014, but this is the challenge. With growth essentially going negative, it's going to be a struggle. And last of all, remember that the Brazilian economic growth has run in a parallel track with the Chinese. You've got resource exports to China, which in the past years have accelerated growth in Brazil. And I think it's a very telling story, Kevin, that, and really a footnote on the Chinese, if you will, that Brazilian growth is waning. Again, follow the money. But if you don't need the resources, if you're seeing a significant slowdown in the Brazilian economy, is it because there's slowing trade with one of your primary trade partners? And I would say that's a good question to be asking.
Well, David, you had talked about following the money, and you can do that with the financial, you can do that with the economic, but sometimes you have to do it with the strategic. And when countries have grown and gotten stronger and then are starting to wane, they start looking around strategically as to what is it that we own that somebody else wants.
Well, and it's thought that the islands in question in South China Sea are laden with oil and gas reserves. So there's a few islands that sit between Taiwan and Japan, and they're actually closer to Taiwan and Japan than they are mainland China. But you see this tension now between Japan and mainland China to the extent that over the weekend we actually had fighter planes in the air on both sides.
These are F-15s, at least on Japan's side.
Exactly. And the Chinese, in a very understated tone, have said that if the Japanese should fire shots of any kind, quote, China will respond without courtesy. I mean, that's the opinion of one person, the general at the Chinese Academy of Military Sciences. The official responses have been, frankly, less diplomatic.
Well, and you know, something that I've read is the Chinese have already said, prepare for the worst. And what they meant by prepare for the worst wasn't necessarily a war with Japan. It was a war with the United States, because the United States has already made a commitment. I believe Hillary Clinton is the one who made the commitment that we would stand by Japan.
Well, and here's a couple of interesting things to keep in mind. Just as sort of the backstory, the Japanese are in an awful mess economically. You had this last week on a CNBC interview, hedge fund manager Kyle Bass basically saying that the Japanese government bond market has 18 to 24 months of a lifeline before implosion. I mean, we talk about the fuses lit here in the United States, and we talk about the U.S. government bond market and U.S. dollar market.
But they have their own fuse.
They do. And again, it's interesting because our endgame is linked to theirs, with interest rates being a critically determinant factor in our solvency and theirs. Again, so you've got the Japanese, which are in an awful mess economically, and all of a sudden, you've got a damaged relationship with the Chinese. Now, this is their number two trade partner.
Right. They need freedom.
This is a relationship that's worth $340 billion. So the fact that they're on the rocks, or on the islands, as it were, with the Chinese is really a bit of an issue because they're already in an economic tough spot. There's layers of problems here because in the backdrop, you've got 20 years of deflationary malaise. On top of that, you've got Fukushima, and now you've got one of your primary trade partners that you may go to war with.
Something else about war, Dave, is the unpredictability of the other side. You have new leadership right now. I mean, Abe is not necessarily new, but he's certainly talking like a new leader.
No, but you have to keep that in mind because with new leadership on both sides, you've got one, Abe, who came to power on a strongly nationalist platform.
Right.
And then you've got Xi Jinping, who, without a strong military background, may want to look tough. I mean, he may need to flex some muscles. So there is that issue as well.
Well, and Abe, he's been traveling a little bit, you know, as he's been visiting countries that seem to be surrounding China.
And this is a major concern when you're looking at the regional stability, when you're looking at regional relationships and who is going to lead in this next decade. Abe's trip in recent weeks, yes, he went to Vietnam, he went to India, he went to the Philippines. And you might think that that's really no big deal.
Right.
You know, I mean, all those places you could go on vacation, all those places you could do business with. But for the Chinese, you may also feel encirclement. You may feel a greater sense of insecurity in your regional positioning and feel like Japan was exercising a move or trying to gain an advantage. So there is a lot at play in this Japanese-Chinese relationship, including the islands.
Well, David, do you know, encirclement was always a concern for Russia as well. When we were in the Cold War, that was one of the key issues. They were continually watching who we were befriending.
We see that today. Clinton has communicated very clearly, and to the chagrin of the Chinese, that we acknowledge the Japanese claim and implicitly, by treaty, support the Japanese. So, in other words, not only is there the F-15s with Japanese markings, but there's a lot more behind them. That is, I think, in play, and the Chinese have a reason to feel uncomfortable. I don't know that our foreign policy in this regard is the smartest foreign policy. Our notion of encirclement in the area, it's playing on the fears of the Chinese, and you don't want to poke a tiger too many times. Let's put it that way. I mean, in all likelihood, the issues will be resolved through diplomatic channels. But sometimes people miscalculate. Sometimes people misread. Sometimes people play the wrong strategy. And sometimes there's enduring consequences.
Well, and you know, it's interesting who your partners are. If your partners, like the United States, are deeply in debt and could somehow use a little bit of the money that Japan might have, there might be a friendship there that's not about tanks and F-15s and battleships.
No, I think that's something else to keep in mind, is, as we've discussed last week, the Japanese and the Abe government will receive even stronger support from the U.S. if the Bank of Japan becomes, let's call them, a double-down partner
right.
on U.S. Treasuries, so that over the next 12 to 18 months, the Japanese central bank, the Bank of Japan, brings $500 billion, brings $1 trillion to the table and buys treasuries. This is very critical because what they're doing is they're propping up the dollar, they're propping up the treasury market, they're slaughtering the value of the yen in order to improve competitiveness.
Right. Well, and you know what's interesting, Dave? We've talked about globalization on a good side where people are actually cooperating for business reasons. But when you see the breakdown of globalization, cooperation between axis and allies, there seems to be divisional cooperation right now instead of unified cooperation.
That is that theme of currency wars, which we started talking about a few months ago, a thematic that is in play. That's what the Japanese are doing right now. They've destroyed 12% of the value of their currency to give themselves an improved trade advantage, and they will continue to do that through the purchase of U.S. treasuries. That layers in, again, that currency war thematic into a real, even if only potential, military conflict. But you're right, this is one more layer into the complexity of globalization. Globalization is to some degree being undone. Another issue which we saw explored in this week's Economist, and I would encourage everyone to get this week's Economist, the issue on onshoring versus offshoring seems a little dry. You're going to have to read between the lines to see what value it has, because really it's the bigger picture that it has an importance to. Who cares if this company or that company is moving 200 employees here or there, but actually there's a major theme here. And again, onshoring is that notion of the return of service sector and manufacturing jobs. And there's a response here. For years, decades now, we've seen the opposite occurring, offshoring, where a company wants to improve profitability and they assume that because of lower labor costs, they can send jobs overseas and basically capture that labor margin in terms of profitability for the company.
Well, and let's face it, that's really what the revolution in China was all about.
Interestingly, this is a theme that the GEAB group, again, that Leap 2020 group, has focused on as a major development in 2013, this idea of neo-protectionism. Mm. 2013 is likely to see more and more emphasis on domestic political and economic priorities. We see that with the Japanese. We see that with the U.S. Protecting the local economy will continue to eclipse the international cooperation and sort of that trend of global free trade. And this is, again, it's underscored by this week's Economist special report on outsourcing and offshoring, in which they explore a growing number of companies who are moving in reverse. They're basically onshoring or bringing jobs back to the United States.
Which does not sound bad on the surface, Dave. I mean, as a citizen of the United States, I'd like to see jobs come back.
No, that is a good news story. Are we always bearish? No, that is a good news story. But quite interesting is the comparison of labor costs, which in most instances were the initial reason for companies to move offshore, again, with certain operations. There are other reasons still to keep operations abroad, and we can talk about that later. But with the increase in shipping costs over the last decade, along with customs fees, the delays in the supply chain, there's a lot of companies now who are looking at sort of a negligible higher all-in cost, even with a higher labor line item here in the United States. Does that make sense? I guess one of the things that we're seeing is that with the rise in the price of oil over the last decade, this advantage of labor being just one production cost has now become less significant.
Right.
So you may gain 5, 10, 15% in terms of profitability by being overseas, but it's not 30, 50, 60, 70, 80%, which it could have been a decade or two ago.
Well, this again is where inflation factors into things that you have to count, because if you've got cheap labor, but you've got inflation in all the transportation costs, storage costs, what have you, it really does change the whole dynamic.
And this is something we talked about 2 to 3 months ago when we were discussing Mexico. And the fact that this is a good news story for Mexico as well in terms of their labor market now being as competitive as China's. But guess what? Their products don't have to spend 5 weeks on a boat getting here.
Right. There's no ocean around Mexico in the United States.
Now, frankly, I'm also suspicious that there are tax incentives here in the U.S., which may also be a part of the reason to return. I don't have any hard numbers on that, except that we did see the secret deals cut in the $73 billion through tax credits given to behemoths like GE. So that may be a part of the story. But the long-term positive here is that we do see employment rates, or at a minimum, economic growth being reoriented to a U.S. marketplace. Jobs, to some degree, will be back in the United States. And this is what BCG, or the Boston Consulting Group, sees as a very significant directional shift. We're moving towards a balance between the jobs that are still being outsourced or moved offshore and the jobs that are now coming back, to where basically it is neutral. It is on balance, net neutral.
So you have just as many jobs now leaving as coming back. That's an amazing balance, Dave. That's revealing compared to what we've been trained to think or what we've thought over the last 2 or 3 decades.
Part of this is to be expected. As we discussed in part 2 in this year's film, The Fuse Is Lit, Asian Ascendance, we talked about China. We talked about the necessary transitions for China and the need for them to raise their incomes. And they are, in fact, doing that. So pay in Asia is rising, particularly in China. And with that, though, comes an increased cost for manufacturing in that country. So it means that those jobs may go elsewhere.
So, you know, Dave, when I call a call center, let's say I call American Airlines or I call Amazon, whoever, I may actually be talking to an American again.
You may actually be talking to an American again. Now, there are a number of countries which are sort of an exception to this, where there's no reason for jobs to come back to the United States. They may go to Myanmar, they may go to Cambodia, they may go to Vietnam. those stand out as exceptions. The other issue, too, is the jobs that come back to the United States are going to be in competition with automation. Mm-hmm. And that really is a critical negative, as much as there is a positive in this idea of reshoring or onshoring, bringing jobs back to the U.S. You have automation, which is a critical negative. Robotics are being introduced on a mass level, and they can be operated anywhere. They don't have to be in South China. They don't have to be in North China. They can be in Kansas City. They can be in Alabama. And again, with the same base cost up front for the plants and the material, but then you're operating something and it's close to your research and development team. It's close to your end user, the person who's going to buy the product directly from you. So you cut out the transportation costs. So again, there are many things changing in the labor market, both in Asia and in the United States.
Well, and David, like we saw in the late 1800s and we saw over the last 30 or 40 years, as we saw the rise of globalization. Now, in the late 1800s, it was fueled by industrialization and the gold standard. And, of course, since the 70s, we've seen globalization occur because of the end of World War II and the restructuring of currencies and a lot of this outsourcing. Now, that did add to a major GDP growth expansion. So, yes, we're bringing jobs back, but what does that do to GDP?
This brings us back to a very critical issue, and it's one that we're going to discuss at length here several weeks from now with Michael Pettis. He'll join us again on the program from Beijing, if he can breathe the air in Beijing. I understand it's been a little rough.
Oh, I've seen some pictures. I showed my daughter.
Did you see anything in the pictures?
It looked like fog.
Exactly. Yeah. Globalization has added to GDP significantly. Globalization has allowed for labor arbitrage. Multinationals could pick and choose where to establish operations in light of lower labor costs. But credit was also a primary driver of globalization, and it's not expanding. It's not in that 30 to 40 year expansion mode. The labor playing field is being leveled by an increase in wages, along with other factors, like we've mentioned, transport costs, the cost of slack in the supply chain. You just think in terms of labor being a smaller part of the total cost to make and deliver goods. So we find ourselves moving back to a form of neo-protectionism. Is it reindustrialization here in the United States? That might be going a step too far. But at least the limited reshoring that we've seen to date begins a healthy process on the one hand. On the other hand, it underscores that we have domestic economic priorities. Domestic economic priorities, that's sort of the opposite of globalization. That's the opposite of free trade. It stands in, I don't know if conflict is the right word, but it's certainly not as compatible.
So, David, this is an inflationary theme. I know you're just about to go see Richard Duncan in the next couple of weeks, and he's focused primarily on what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, he's in the U.S., and he's touring, discussing his book, and we're going to have dinner here in the next couple of weeks. What we discussed last year with Richard was that low wages and globalization covered over years of government printing and offset inflationary trends with a strongly deflationary component. Now, if you step away from that idea and look at what we've been talking about today, rising wages and a pendulum swing away from globalization, what you're really arguing for is a period of higher inflation rates. And if you have higher inflation rates, let's circle back around to what we were talking about in relation to Brazil, you also have contracting GDP figures, again, should you use an appropriate deflator, if that appropriate inflation rate is recognized, the reason companies will continue to keep operations in other jurisdictions will be to access the emerging market that they think they can sell product into, not necessarily for labor arbitrage. So again, if we're losing the labor subsidy, we can expect to see over the next 3 to 5 to 7 years a major reversion from what has been a disinflationary or even deflationary environment, disinflationary for 20 to 30 years, deflationary environment in the last 4 to 5, given the contraction in credit and the crisis mode that we've been in since 2008.
So when we talk about outsourcing or we talk about bringing jobs back or onshoring, we're not only talking about people. We're not only talking necessarily about physical, hard, tangible products. What we're also talking about is intellectual property.
This is, I think, at the core of the technological revolution and evolution that we continue to see unfold in front of us. corporations are more and more suspicious, skeptical, concerned, protective of their proprietary processes and intellectual property rights. And so it's going to be natural in a period of global economic consolidation to see firms pull back a bit because they're just not extending trust anymore. In a microcosm of that, you know, the McKinsey Global Institute there in Seoul, South Korea, points out that outsourcing or going offshore carries a number of disadvantages, including the revelation of proprietary processes, including sharing intellectual property. And it's interesting. I mean, we're talking about Seoul, South Korea, and it reminds us of Samsung. This is a profound reminder because they once were a very small firm used for outsourcing by a number of Japanese firms. And now they dwarf all of their previous customers.
Right.
And note that South Korean firms almost never outsource. And I wonder why.
Yeah, I guess it's the same reason why you don't pick up a wasp from the ground.
But this is, I think, this growing trend of domestic concerns, domestic considerations, protection of property rights, protection of intellectual property rights in particular. So how are you lining things up in an age where there's greater conflict? As we talked about several months ago, this is not just the conflict that we might see between the Japanese and Chinese. This is an economic, this is a financial conflict, and it includes things like using your currency as your primary weapon.
Well, David, that's what this year's theme has been. I know for you, the three videos that we've made that you've actually gone all over the world to make started out with Europe and the complexities there, but there's complexity, but once you understand it, there's actual simplicity. When you get to Asia, the same thing, complexity. That was the second DVD, The Fuse is Lit Part 2. The Fuse is Lit Part 3 really ties everything together, and that, of course, was just released this last weekend.
It's titled An American Reckoning. If somebody wants to go to YouTube, you can put it into the search function as The Fuse is Lit Part 3.
Right.
If you want a hard copy, you can call our office or go online to orderdvdtoday.com and get a hard copy. I would suggest getting a hard copy because it's something that I think you're going to want to pass on to your kids, pass on to your friends, pass on to your coworkers as something just to say, hey, I don't want this to get stuck in your inbox, and you might not have seen it otherwise, but if you have 20 minutes when you get home, because that's about how short it is, take a look at it. I'd love to discuss it with you. Get a hard copy. Again, you can order it at orderdvdtoday.com. We pick up the shipping. We cover all the costs of production and just hope that you learn something from it and take very seriously some of the conclusions which tie directly to the U.S. bond and dollar markets. Again, this is an American reckoning. The conclusion of a three-part series, The Fuse is Lit, for us really is the dominant theme as we look forward to 2013, 14, 15, and 16. The next 4 years, as we've just gotten past the inauguration and look forward to what the next 4 years may hold, these are some financial, economic, and even a few political considerations as well.
So for the person who has a computer and wants to just immediately look at it, they can go to YouTube and they can basically search The Fuse is Lit Part 3, or they can go online and say orderdvdtoday.com, right?
Orderdvdtoday.com, and again, we cover all the costs to get it to you.
Well, and a lot of people who listen to the show actually don't turn their computer on that often, so they can call us at 800-525-9556, and we'll be happy to send you a hard copy, a good old-fashioned DVD.
Now, it's going to take about 2 weeks to produce it. You can create things digitally a lot faster than you can in real, hard form. So, believe it or not, there'll be copies coming direct to you from China.
They're on the boat. Let's just put it that way. Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call again at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.